Hello, and welcome to Travel Fun. My name is Mary Beth Clementi, and I am the host of this talk show on travel. And today, I am taking you to Bhutan, and that's actually going to be with the help of author Lisa Napoli. And Lisa has written a wonderful book entitled Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, The Happiest Kingdom on Earth. And that was released this year. And I am happy to have Lisa Napoli on the phone from Los Angeles. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to Travel Fun.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Let me tell the listeners right off that you have worked in public radio for years and that you were in some kind of a midlife crisis, although midlife, I don't think that that's the best term to use when you're early 40s, but in any event, that's what you used in your book, but that's great. And you met a cute guy at a party in New York and ended up traveling to Bhutan to help the Bhutanese with their newly founded radio station. And that's kind of the story of your book in a nutshell. And it takes the reader on a wonderful adventure to Bhutan. I'm going to say right off that I have never been there. I've never been to that part of the world. And so why don't you first talk about Bhutan? What's it like? Describe it.
Well, it's a small country. It's about the size of Switzerland. It's in the Himalayas, nestled between Nepal and Tibet and India. It's got about 650,000 people. It's very rocky, very mountainous. Probably parts of it look very much like where you are talking to me from right now, except that Bhutan didn't have roads or currency, hard currency, or electricity. It didn't allow outsiders in. All until about 40 years ago. So it's been an amazing period of growth and development for this country. Perhaps the most famous thing about Bhutan, well, two famous things, is that it didn't allow in television until 1999, so there was no TV, no internet either. And it's famous for measuring its well-being in gross national happiness, not GDP, which is what much of the rest of the world does. So that's made it sort of the subject of a lot of study all over the world in the last couple of years, especially as the economy has tanked so dismally.
Well, I think people have heard a lot about that notion of gross national happiness in relation to Bhutan. How exactly do they measure gross national happiness?
Well, you know, they don't really. GNH, the whole concept of GNH came about in the 70s when the then king announced that he was much more, or said to an interviewer, that he was much more focused on the people's happiness than he was on the GDP. And that's, of course, as things are really ramping up across Asia as far as production, the industrial age, really settling in there. And he said he didn't want that to be the case in Bhutan, that he wanted to protect and preserve the environment, that he didn't want rampant economic growth at the expense of the well-being of the people, that he didn't want the growth to come at the expense of the environment. So basically he was saying, almost even tongue-in-cheek, that the gross national happiness is more important. People have been, in the last few years, clamoring for indicators and measurements of these metrics. You know, how do I tell if the people are happy? And frankly, Bhutan has scrambled to come up with ways to measure those things because for them, it was innate. They're a devout Buddhist country. For them, the middle path, treading the middle path and being deliberate with growth in a measured way came naturally for them. So they've been coming up with indicators, but so have people around the world who studied it. Like there's a group in Seattle right now, Sustainable Seattle, who are working really hard to come up with these metrics to measure the well-being of the people there, borrowing from the principles, the preservation of the environment, preservation of the culture, preservation of the family, that are inherent in Bhutan. So it's interesting. You know, you think about whether you have GNH in your life. If you're traveling 2 hours to work every day, well, then you probably don't. And now there's people who are trying to quantify that with a scale.
Now, you said that television was introduced in 1999, and is that the same time that Internet arrived in the country?
Yeah, the day that the TV station was switched on was the day the Internet was switched on. But, of course, you know, switching on the capability of getting onto the Internet or even turning on a television is predicated on your having a television and a computer, and many people in Bhutan at the time did not. So it's ramped up gradually, as the same thing with phones. You know, many people never had a landline in Bhutan, and now as cell phones were introduced over the last, I think it's 8 years that they've come in and they just barrel in with a vengeance. That's been the case with TV and Internet, too, although, of course, the barrier to entry is a little bit more expensive there. But nonetheless, yes, those two came in at the same time. And they're two hugely menacing forces, as we all know. We all use them, probably, I would assume most people listening. But radio was not even that widespread in Bhutan in 1999. There was only one station. So when I was invited to go help start a radio station there, radio was a pretty spaceshipy kind of thing, very, very advanced, because a lot of people had never turned on a radio, didn't have a radio, didn't know that the concept of that medium, which we consider very retro.
And what year was that?
I went in 2007, which also turned out to be a time of another massive change, because the king had just abdicated the throne and said that his young son would take over just as the country would transition peacefully to democratic rule. So I went unwittingly at a time that was quite a very important time for the country, and that this radio station was being set up not just as a frivolous kind of thing, but as something for the young people of Bhutan to get used to the concept of democracy.
And talk about how you embarked upon this adventure to Bhutan and your role with the radio station.
Sure. I was, as you had said, I worked in public radio. I worked at the public radio show Marketplace. I'd had a pretty nice career as a journalist. I'd worked at all kinds of nice A-list sorts of places. I'm from a modest family from Brooklyn, so I was proud that I'd worked at the New York Times and worked at MSNBC. I'd gone to a nice little alternative college, Hampshire College. So life is moving along okay, but it seemed kind of treadmill-like to me in my early 40s. And then I met a cute guy at a cocktail party who was a tea importer. And he made an offhanded remark about going to Bhutan for sourcing of tea and joked that I should come with him. And long story short, a few weeks later, he wrote and asked if I wanted to go to Bhutan to help start a radio station there, and I at first thought he was just being flirtatious, and then I realized it was a real offer, and I followed up on it, and it changed my life. It's a perfect story to sort of exemplify that you never know who you might meet and what they're going to change your, how they're going to change your life, because in my case, it really was true.
Had you traveled much before you set off for Bhutan?
I'm not from a big family of travelers, but, you know, I had certainly traveled a fair amount. You know, I'm much more into travel than I am into things, and if anybody ever invited me someplace, I'd go. I wasn't a big vacationer. You know, I wouldn't be a resort-going kind of person, but if there was a reason to go somewhere, I always liked to. And I've been all over Europe. I had a lot of friends in the Netherlands because I'd covered a hackers convention there. I'd been to Africa once on a press junket, and that was very exciting, to go to Botswana and Namibia. But no, I wasn't a world traveler. I certainly had not been to Asia, and I knew very, very little about Bhutan. But that's sort of in keeping with how things work with me. You say, go, and I'll say, okay, sure, and I'll figure out a way to go.
Talk about life at Kuzu FM And in fact, it might be good to start out reading an excerpt from your book.
Sure.
That I thought really kind of gave me the feel of the radio station. I imagined it, and I think a lot of people listening will think it might sound familiar to our little radio station here in Telluride.
Sure.
Do you want to start?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sure. This is from page 109 of Radio Shangri-La. It doesn't take much to create a radio program, a microphone or two, a mixing board, a transmitter, and a relatively quiet room. That was about all Kuzu had, along with a couple of faded Backstreet Boys and Spice Girls posters taped up on the walls and an on-air sign mounted outside the studio. Its lighting mechanism worked about half the time, but almost everyone ignored it anyway. They'd just barrel into the studio, regardless of whether someone was transmitting live. Kuzu FM was what most radio stations in the United States hadn't been for a very long time, and anything goes bullhorn to the people. Core staff of paid radio jockeys kept the station going, but anyone who was interested could just show up and contribute however they wished. You could bring in music, you could hang out in the studio with whoever was hosting the show, though eventually there were rules prohibiting that. You could answer phones. Volunteers weren't just welcome, they were encouraged. Even the typical college station in the United States had long ago ceased to be so egalitarian. Sounds like where you're talking to me from, Mary Beth. And what's so cool for me about going into a place like this is that, you know, I'd worked in media for so long, and I kind of became blasé about it. I knew that it was powerful, and I knew that people listened to it. But when you work on a national stage, it's a different sort of appeal or reach than you get when you work in community, and you know that, you know, you're running into someone at the grocery store who heard your story or who wants to talk about what they were listening to on the radio. And that's exactly what Kuzu was. But again, it was that, and there was nothing else competing with it. So it really was a singular voice in the community. People were not accustomed to it. Completely blank media landscape was the case in Bhutan in 2007. It's very different now. There are 7 stations, 7 newspapers. Freedom of the press is guaranteed in the new constitution that was enacted in 2008. And people have really taken advantage of that in a good way. But those first few months of Kuzu FM were so exciting, at least for me, as this sort of jaded, you know, New York City, Los Angeles, big city journalist kind of person.
And what I really enjoy in your book, Radio Shangri-La, when you're writing about the radio station Kuzu FM in Bhutan, you're talking about this whole cast of characters, both people that work at the radio station and that people you interact with in your life in Bhutan. And it really gives you a good sense of the Bhutanese people.
Yes. Yes. You know, it's so fortunate when you can go somewhere and see it through the lens of the people who live there. And in my case, for me, to be introduced to Bhutan in this way was just spectacular. I mean, I couldn't have imagined. I meet a lot of people who go on vacation to Bhutan, and they fall in love with it, and I completely understand the feeling. But I fell in love with it because I was working and living there every day, going to the store, figuring out food, seeing how people lived. And there's no greater privilege in the world than that in any place. But particularly in a place like Bhutan, where people do spend so much money to go on vacation, and which has been closed to people for so long, it was a particular privilege.
Right. People have to, if they travel to Bhutan, is it still a $200 a day tourist tax?
It's a $200 a day tourist tax. It's about to go up to $250 a day, and it's sort of a misnomer because that's the minimum amount that you can spend if you enter Bhutan. You can't spend less, but you may spend much more. It covers a lot of different things. So a lot of people think that means you just pay the $200 and then you have to come up with money for a driver and a hotel and food. It's still expensive, but it's not as expensive as it sounds to the ear when you say tax. There is a very, very fancy way to go to Bhutan, and people do go that way. A lot of Hollywood celebrities go to a series of very, very pricey resorts. But they definitely don't encourage the spiritual kind of backpackers who you see, say, in India.
Okay. I am visiting with Lisa Napoli, and we're talking about her book, Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Travel Fun. I'm visiting with Lisa Napoli, author of Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. And I believe that your publisher is Crown Publishing?
Yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. Great. And that came out this year. And we're talking about Bhutan and her experience working at a radio station in Bhutan, and you were a mentor of sorts to so many of the people there. Right before the break, we were talking about different ways to travel to Bhutan. You had the privilege of living there and really experiencing the culture firsthand and not being a tourist per se. If somebody is going to travel there as a tourist, how would you recommend they do it? Or I imagine maybe you can only do it on an organized tour. I don't know too much about that, actually.
Yeah, you have to go. You can't just say, let's go to Bhutan and get on a plane. You have to go through a tour operator. And there are a number of them in this country who work in concert with ones based in Bhutan, or you can just go directly to the one in Bhutan if you have one or you're interested. I can certainly help people if they write to me at lisa@lisanapoli.com. I'm happy to help connect them. I have no vested interest in it. Buy my book if you're going to go, or even if you're not going to go. I'm not an expert on Bhutan travel. I've been there 6 times, but I've always gone as a guest. But I do know that there are these reliable operators and that you can't just waltz into the country and drive around, rent a car, and you always need an operator, tour guide and driver with you. And it's become easier to go, apparently, not in a big group, but it costs you probably a little bit more if you go just yourself or with a couple of other people. So,
okay. And also on my blog, bonjourcolorado.com, I have a piece up there on service travel, and it features a Telluride local, Sharon Shooterin, who has been spending a lot of time in Bhutan the past few years, and she does service work there. So that's another idea for people looking to get to that part of the world. The Himalayas. go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt. Although, without having heard the story, I will caution that I do get lots of email from people who want to go donate time and help there, but it's very difficult. She must have some sort of pipeline, and it's very difficult to connect people. There isn't a real existing framework yet for putting volunteers, good work, and good intentions to use there. So it can be a frustration for those who are used to dealing with countries that have the Peace Corps or well-established volunteer organizations that know how to route people. There are some ways to do it, but again, it's not. I don't want people to think that it's it's just a matter of saying, I want to go work there, volunteer my services there. It can be very complicated.
It sounds like it still is fairly closed.
Closed, and also the infrastructure just isn't there. It's just not there yet for that kind of stuff, that kind of work.
Okay.
I was very, very fortunate that I just sort of waltzed in. You know, it's sort of what the Buddhists believe, or many people of this philosophy believe, that it's much easier to find something when you're not looking for it. And that was definitely the case for me.
Lisa, let's talk a little bit about this relationship you have with Bhutan, especially the one that's revealed in the book. And I think a great way to start with that is if you read about loving Bhutan from your book.
Yes. Here, let me open that one up. I'm so excited that you wanted me to read from it.
That's on page 98. That paragraph really resonated with me.
Great. Loving Bhutan is, like so many love affairs, complicated. It's not like becoming a Francophile or a fan of Hawaii or using every vacation to visit all the national parks or Major League Baseball stadiums or NASCAR racetracks in the United States. Bhutan is on a checklist kind of vacation on which you hit the hot spots. Not an easy place, not a luxurious place to adore. It has many flaws, and it is rife with contradictions. It doesn't boast the typical assets common to vacation destinations, such as plentiful sunshine 12 months a year or expert chefs who avail themselves of the bountiful fields. If you happen to be a fan of chanterelles and fiddle-held ferns, time to visit during the short summer season when they are as plentiful as kudzu. Bhutan may be simple and unspoiled in the way rural America might have been at the turn of the 20th century. With a tour guide beside you, it may seem like the promised Shangri-La, some sort of fairy tale with endless miles of untouched land and vistas of mountains and trees so lush it's hard to imagine they're real. But it is poor, it is rough, and the sum total of the good and the bad and the strange combine to render Bhutan captivating and magnificent.
Ah, well, it makes me want to go.
Good.
It does. Let's talk about some of what you like most about Bhutan, and because certainly you describe so many of the unique charms of that land in a very enchanting manner in your book.
You're nice to say that. I think people ask me all the time that if I had been invited to go start a radio station or do anything somewhere else in the country, do they think I would have fallen in love with the place as much? And I don't know. I mean, it's true about people, too, right? Do you fall in love with the next person you meet because it's the right person? It's a combination of factors. For me, Bhutan, because it was so remote and underexplored, because it was in this amazing period of transition with the impending democracy, with the radio station being such a new and unique addition, the media landscape so raw, the people so eager and unused to outsiders, and just the sheer spectacular beauty of the place, and just where I was in my life, really searching. I sort of would never have identified myself as a Buddhist, but I was always intrigued by that kind of philosophy. I was a big yoga practitioner for a long time. It just sort of grew together. It kind of just drew together all these things that were so interesting and intriguing and important to me. You know, I grew up in New York City, and I remember meeting people along the way as a young woman who said, oh, yeah, I thought I was born in the wrong place. I grew up wanting to be born in New York City. And I totally understand what that feeling is like now, because I just really felt at home in Bhutan, even though I knew very little about it. And I don't know if that describes it at all, but there's something about the pace of life and the people, the fact that it's such a colorful place, it's such a lush place. The fact that the religion is practiced so openly is also very interesting to me, and was very intriguing and captivating.
Well, you mentioned color, and that's one of the things. Paint us a picture. You talk about the brightly colored clothing that people wore in their national dress, and also the architecture and woodwork. It just sounds enchanting.
It is. It is. It's like stepping into a back lot of, not to reduce it to that, but it almost doesn't seem real because the architecture is all around, looks very similar. And so everywhere you go, it resembles each other. When there is architecture, then there's the rolling land, the hills, the mountains, the greenery, just miles and miles of it. And the people all are, ethnically homogenous for the most part, wearing this beautiful national costume, if you will, it's out of this world. It's not like anything that I can see looking out of my noisy window here in downtown Los Angeles, where everybody looks so different. So that was just such a spectacular experience to step into a world and to be a minority in a world that was so so beautiful and bright, and it just expanded my whole perspective on the world.
And that's why, too, I think your book, Radio Shangri-La, is great for armchair travelers. When you think of so many people that will never go to Bhutan, but they can travel there through your words.
Hopefully, that's so nice. But it's also interesting, if you literally want to go somewhere, you can go to El Paso, Texas, and get a big flavor of Bhutan in a very interesting way that I write about in the book, the connection between the two places. It goes back 100 years, and I leave that a mystery. But I hope that the book just takes people really on a journey for themselves. It's interesting. It's become a book that people read because they're interested and have been or are going to Bhutan, but I really hope it reaches a wider audience because the messages, I hope, are greater, that there's, a big world out there, but what's in your world right in front of you is really what's most important, and there's so much you can do in your world, if you're not happy with it, to change your circumstances. There's very few impediments that most of us listening have to making a change, and I needed to rattle my life and go halfway around the world, and it's made me resettle into life here in a whole different, renewed way.
And Lisa, without giving away the end of the book, which I haven't read yet, and certainly I don't want people that haven't cracked your book yet to know, where are you at now in your life? You're back in LA, and what are you doing now? What are you working on?
Well, I'm talking to kind people like you who are helping me spread the word about Radio Shangri-La, and which is not a small task. It's a very big task to sell a book. I'm also working on another book, actually another two books in proposal form right now. I do a lot of volunteering in Los Angeles. I'd like to do a lot more. And I swim every day. And I just have a nice life where I've successfully so far escaped the daily grind of the media that I loved and was so fortunate to be a part of, but that I really needed to step back from. So,
terrific. Enjoy. And there's a lot we can find out about you at your website blog, and that's lisanapoli.com. And yeah. Napoli is Napoli. Another nice Italian gal.
Yes.
You probably recognize my name. Rings a little Italian. Clementi.
Yes. Yes.
And definitely go there. Check it out. I have been visiting with Lisa Napoli, author of Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. Lisa, thank you so much for being a guest on Travel Fun, and continued success.
Oh, and to you too. Thank you so much, and have a happy summer to everyone.
Yes, and I am going to be posting this interview as a podcast and putting up a story at my blog, bonjourcolorado.com. So be sure to check that out. Thanks for tuning in. Lisa, take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.